This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A few years ago, poet Donald Hall began a memoir called Life Work. The book was to be about his passion for writing and reading, and about what work meant to his parents and grandparents who labored on the family farm. He felt that he was writing his book in defiance of death. A couple of years before he started the memoir, he lost half of his colon to cancer. The recurrence he lived in fear of was diagnosed midway through his work on the memoir. The cancer had metastasized to his liver. Doctors gave him a 1 in 3 chance of living more than 5 years. Hall's memoir ends just as his chemotherapy is about to begin. He writes how close he is to his wife of 22 years, Jane Kenyon. She's also a highly regarded poet, and she too has a new book called Constance. We invited Hall and Kenyon to join us to read from their books and to discuss the impact of illness on their work and their marriage. First, Donald Hall will read an excerpt of his memoir, Life Work.
If all goes well, as it were, I will by inches recover the morning globe, the coffee, work on poems and work on prose, walking the dog, love with Jane, and the continual or recurrent dread, exacerbated every 3 months by checking my CEA, that a black cell multiplies. It's a common condition for millions of people. Old ones dropping off and new ones entering the mode. The cancer club, the death watch. Heaven knows, at moments of anxiety, magic thinking knows no let or hindrance. They are reading everything I write on this yellow pad. I'll take it, I'll take it. The nature of this book alters. Shall I change the title from Life Work to Work and Death? Box office, he said, sneering. Oh, let me return to my theme. I've worked all this pre-operation week, but not on life work. Absorbedness has helped, and absorbedness is incomplete. This morning, as I write this medical report for life work, I find that work remains the matter, not only in defiance of death, but in plain sight of it. It absorbs me to write these pages. It absorbs me more nearly than anything else has done for the past week or 10 days. Writing about cancer allows me to transcend my cancer by the syntax or rhetoric of dread and suffering. If work is no antidote to death, nor a denial of it, death is a powerful stimulus to work. Get done what you can. When I'm sick after my operation, not only sore but bonkers, the way anesthesia leaves you, I will write nothing, or at least nothing well. But I can fill the days before the operation with work on life work. And I'm determined to write about something besides dying. There's so much I haven't touched on, like my grandfather's daily work, my grandmother Kate's labors, women's work, and ideas from sociologists of work. I have a list of topics to keep me busy. The alternative is tears, appropriate enough, but miserable. I keep thinking of Jane, of my mother, of my children and grandchildren. I'm not exactly afraid, but I'm surely sad. Talking with a friend today, I said that I was surprised not to feel more frightened. I was surprised to feel pity for Jane more than pity for myself. Not that I'm without self-pity. Quickly, I called myself egotistical for thinking that my death was the worst thing that could happen to Jane. Then both of us said at the same time, yes, but it is the worst thing that could happen to Jane.
Donald Hall, thank you for reading that. Has the meaning of work changed for you since the cancer?
I think it's intensified. It's actually this patch of my life is one of the best patches yet. I think it's more serious, more intense. I'm not scared all the time or panicky. I mean, that by this time, I feel this fears and panics rather rarely. But goodness knows the preciousness of the hour is greater still, and the preciousness of the hour in doing what I love the most. One of the things I love the most, that's one of the more consistent things over 50 years, is the struggle with language that I spoke of.
How is your health now?
Right now I feel wonderful, and my tests lately are just fine. I'm perfectly aware that this could happen, that this could go away quickly, and that the chances are not very good. But right now I'm fine. There's no trace of cancer in me right now that anything can measure.
Let me just paraphrase something that you wrote in at the end of the reading that you gave at the beginning of our talk. You were saying that you were thinking that your death could be the worst thing that ever happened to your wife, Jane. Let me introduce your wife, Jane Kenyon, the wonderful poet who's with us as well. And Jane, can I ask you what your reaction was when you read that passage?
Well, I had to agree with it. It really is the worst thing that could happen to me. We're extremely close, both as human beings and as writers. We share so many of the same joys and difficulties. We're extremely close. We live and work in the same building 24 hours a day, and we're very much in each other's pockets. So it really would be devastating for me to lose my pal.
I'd like to ask you to read a poem, and this is a poem about your husband after surgery, and the poem is called Chrysanthemums.
Right. This one is about the first round we had before he had metastasis to the liver. So, Chrysanthemums. The doctor averted his eyes while the diagnosis fell on us, as though the picture of the girl hiding from her dog had suddenly fallen off the wall. We were speechless all the way home. The light seemed strange. A weekend of fear and purging. Determined to work, he packed his dictaphone, a stack of letters, and a roll of stamps. At last, the day of scalpels, blood, and gauze arrived. Eyes closed, I lay on his tightly made bed, waiting. From the hallway, I heard an old man whose nurse was helping him to walk. That Howard Johnson's, it's nothing but the same thing over and over again. That's right, it's nothing special. Late in the afternoon, when slanting sun betrayed a wad of dust under the bedside stand, I heard the sound of casters and footsteps slowing down. The attendants asked me to leave the room while they moved him onto the bed, and the door remained closed for a long time. Evening came. While he dozed fitfully, still stupefied by anesthetics, I tried to read, my feet propped on the rails of the bed. Odette's chrysanthemums were revealed to me, ranks of them in the house where Swan, jealousy constricting his heart, made late-night calls. And while I read, pausing again and again to look at him, the smell of chrysanthemums sent by friends wavered from the sill, mixing with the smells of drastic occasions and disinfected sheets.
That's an excerpt of Jane Kenyon's poem Chrysanthemums, and the poem is included in her new collection of poetry, Constance. Jane, how long after the surgery did you actually write that poem?
I guess it was, the surgery was in the autumn. It was in September. It would have been in the months following, in that winter following.
When you write a poem that's about Don, or Don, when you write a poem that has to do with Jane, do you show it to each other right away?
Not right away, but we always work together on poems.
Even the poems about each other?
Oh, yes. Yes. We also work with other friends. Each of us has our own committee, you might say, and we work very closely with other friends. But we do indeed work on each other's poems. And there are times when we just, I simply have to say to Don, well, I can't tell you about this because I just can't get far enough away from it to have much judgment about it.
Jane, at what point in the development of Chrysanthemums did you show the poem to Don?
Well, it was many months after I started it, and I felt uncomfortable about this poem because I was revealing very personal things in it, and I wasn't sure how Don would feel about it. And I remember prefacing my showing this poem to him by saying you may feel that this is too personal and that I didn't have a right to reveal these things. It's best to be careful about hurting people in this way.
Because I wasn't hurt at all, but I mean, I suppose I'm glad to be asked.
And then, Don, did you work on that poem at all?
I can't remember. I mean, almost always I have something to say. It's famous in our house that Jane will show me a poem and I'll say, this is going to be good. And Jane will say, going to be, eh? You know, I mean, I love her poems. But I'm always telling her to take out the word and there and take the comma out here. Take this line from the end of one line and put it at the beginning of the next. And she tells me the same things, of course. Endlessly. And we often do what the other says, but not always. I don't remember what in particular I said about this, but the fact that it was about me and my illness would not keep me from having ideas about the sound of it, the style of it, the poetry of it. I mean, at first, I read it, it's a poem about me, kabump, I'm struck by it, and then by that fact, and then I start hearing the cadences and looking at the images, and if I see anything that doesn't sound quite right to me, I'll tell her. That's what we're useful for to each other in this particular way.
Is there ever any friction between the two of you of who has ownership over a certain experience that you both shared, and who has more of the right to write about it?
Well, sometimes when something particularly piquant happens to us, one of us will say, jump ball.
Or dibs. I remember being with a bunch of poets years and years ago back at Ann Arbor. Jane was one of them. And somebody said something terrific, you know, a good phrase, just adjective, a noun or something. And everybody started yelling, dibs, dibs, on that. I don't think that we've really had any friction on this. We have written about the same thing, but we write differently enough. We can do that. It's all right. I mean, we wrote poems at about the same time about the Gulf War. This is not personal experience in this case, but it was really kind of amusing. Hers, in this particular case, is 10 times better than mine. And this is not modesty. It's just objective fact. But mine is so absolutely a man's poem. Hers is so absolutely a woman's poem. It's just comical.
It's a joke, really.
Yeah.
What, can you give me an example of lines that for you epitomize the male?
You have it in
there,
don't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, mine is a poem which begins with the act of tearing up an old nightgown for rags, an old flannel nightgown. And then the poem in the second stanza moves to making supper while listening to NPR, to the news, all things considered, and thinking of the war. So that the tearing up of the nightgown is like the dismemberment of the body. And the imaginative leap is from the tearing up of the nightgown to the torture and suffering of people caught in this awful, awful war. It's inward and it's grief-stricken and it's... my poem is personal and domestic in a way, and Don's is utterly public and political and brings in layers of history. It's noisy and ebullient, and they just couldn't be more different.
Yeah. This is an unfair comparison, and I'm the one who made it. But mine is historical and outward and very sarcastic, very ironic. It talks about if Lord Gilgamesh cannot... Gilgamesh was Saddam Hussein, as it were. I mean, he was king of the same territory. And then the coalition of Lord Agamemnon and Napoleon and all sorts of people with missiles and, it's full of history, allusion, and irony. And it's very outward and kind of bombastic. It makes fun of itself. But that's the contrast. That's enough of it.
My guests are poets Donald Hall and Jane Kenyon. They have been married for over 20 years, and they each have new books. Donald Hall's new book is a memoir called Life Work. Jane Kenyon's new book is a collection of poems called Constance. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guests are poets and husband and wife Donald Hall and Jane Kenyon. You've both written about battles with depression. And I'm wondering if you think it makes you more sensitive to each other's mood swings, or if it causes certain problems if you're not on the same mood swing schedule, so to speak.
We try to arrange so that we're not both down or both up at the same time. I think that we try to arrange for one of us to be manic and the other depressed at the same time so that we, you know, it's like Plato's ball, or is it Plato or Socrates, who first imagined the human being as a sphere. You know, if you put us together, if you put the manic right. and the depressive together, press them together into a ball, you'd have a whole human being. And I've often thought that if someone took the two of us and shook us up in a brown paper bag and turned us out, there would really be one complete human being.
we have had moments when we were both pretty low, which are very hard moments because when you're so low, you can't help the other person. But that hasn't happened very often, as Jane says. I think that there is a mechanism in us that tries to, or that is able to compensate when the other is inevitably lower. When I think I had my most recent illness, Jane had been rather low, and she just rose to the challenge totally and was totally nurturing and... then when I was better, she sagged down again, and I was able to help a little. I noticed that. Maybe I'm inaccurate, but it seems something
no,
like that
No, I did make a special effort to pull myself together there.
It's the time when you think you cannot possibly make an effort, that you're making every effort you can, and circumstances require something from you, and you have it that you didn't think you had.
Do you think that your depressions have become more pronounced in the face of illness, or do you think that it's easier to transcend depressions when you're facing something as, you know, monumental as cancer?
Oh, it's hard to answer that. I mean, my serious depressions began when I was in my early 30s. They began in the year after my father died dreadfully of cancer. And my really incapacitating depressions began in my early 30s. And I've been on medication ever since.
Jane, I'm thinking here of a poem that you wrote called Having It Out with Melancholy,
mm-hmm.
in which you're basically addressing melancholy.
Yes.
And you say to it, "You taught me to exist without gratitude. You ruined my manners toward God. Quote, we're here simply to wait for death. The pleasures of earth are overrated." How often do you find yourself thinking that now?
Well, it happens. It happens despite everybody's best efforts and all the fancy pharmaceutical footwork that could be imagined. I began this poem not when I was at the absolute nadir, but close to it. I thought to myself, sometime I must write a poem in which I reveal the experience of depression so that people who have never experienced such awful agony, inward agony, so that those people might understand a little more what it's like and stop telling us to shape up, go buy a hat, go take a nice walk. I really meant to speak for all of us who have been incapacitated by our emotional life. And even though I was too low when I conceived of the poem, I was too low to actually begin working on it. I did conceive of the poem when I was in fact a very, very depressed state.
Don, in writing about T.S. Eliot, you were quoting Eliot as saying, "No honest poet can ever feel quite sure of the permanent value of what he has written. He may have wasted his time and messed up his life for nothing."
Yep.
Do you both feel confident of the value of your work?
No. Not at all. It is a matter of mood. I mean, in the morning, when I've been working, if I wander out and see Jane some mornings, I may say, mocking myself, "I am great," or "I am immeasurably great." And another morning, I will characterize myself in terms of an obscenity, meaning I'm no good at all, I never was. And I feel it strongly then, and part of my mind also knows, tomorrow you'll feel different. You don't know. I don't know. There are times when I get depressed about my work and I think nothing is ever any good, more seriously than the mood thing I was talking about. When I really feel very depressed about everything I've spent my life on. And there are other times when I feel, well, not so much confident about it, just happy with it. Happy with the endeavor, with the continuing endeavor. That does not translate into anything like knowledge that my work will endure. I had to give up on that a long time ago. When I was, say, 15 years old, I thought I wanted to be, you know, a great poet. I wanted to be on the top of the mountain. And I thought that at some point I would find out whether I got there or not. Well, when I was in my 20s, I began to realize that you never know. And when I asked Eliot the question, do you know you're good? Eliot was the Nobel Prize winner. Everybody thought he was the greatest poet since Dante, practically. I mean, it was a moment of Eliot worship. And when I asked him that, I had the suspicion that he would say he didn't know. And that's exactly what he said, as you quoted him.
Jane, what about you?
Well, the conviction that you may be writing something worth having written comes and goes. But the thing that does not come and go, the thing that remains constant, I think, for both of us, is the desire to really make art and to embody the truth and to make something beautiful and to make something that really makes people's lives better. Gives them deeper understanding of their own existence and great joy because of beauty. That desire never goes, no matter how depressed I am about what I've been writing lately or not writing. I still have that desire, and I know in Don too. It's very, very strong.
Jane Kenyon and Donald Hall. Hall's new memoir, Life Work, is published by Beacon. Kenyon's new collection of poems, Constance, is published by Grey Wolf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.